You can be seated. Now we're going to start this new set. We're going to talk about the Abrahamic Covenant tonight. And while I was hoping to do this in 1 week, I think realistically it's going to be at least two. But this is one of those things where, in all sincerity, if I had to, I could probably talk to you about the Abrahamic Covenant in 15 minutes and how it relates to eschatology in 10 to 15 minutes. But I think that that would be a great disservice. And to be honest with you, the more I study this, the more I get involved in putting things together. And so I find it quite fascinating. We're going to go through in a little bit of detail the promises that God made to Abraham, because they are the foundation. Not only, I mean, we're looking at it in particular in relation to eschatology, but it really is the foundation for the rest of Revelation. So let's talk a little bit about Abraham tonight. And like I have said in the past, if you have questions or comments, please raise your hand. All right. Do you want to get one from Mr. Phillip? So let's begin by, again, just stopping to think about Abraham for just a minute. When we looked at, and I don't know if you have the notes from the last time, but if you look at the time frame of Abraham in relation to all of history, which is back on page 31, if you have that, you can look there. If not, that's fine. But as Dean pointed out a few weeks ago, Abraham is actually not too far from the center of history. If we talk about a biblical understanding of when creation took place and where we are today, Abraham is actually closer to the center than we might anticipate. If you stop to think about, actually the center from a historical perspective would be David at 1000 BC. But if you think about it, Abraham lived, Abraham was 2,000 years beyond creation. In other words, he was as far from creation, Adam and Eve and so forth, as we are from Christ. Okay, that's how far Abraham was. So we often think of Abraham as the beginning. But Abraham wasn't the beginning. There were at least 2,000 years of history and God working in the world that come before Abraham. We don't think of that because it only is 11 chapters in the Bible, Genesis 1 through 11. But that represents at least 2,000 years. And that's something to consider. And when you stop to think about Abraham, he was born, when Abraham was born, Noah had just died. Again, if we follow the strict chronologies, he had just died 3 years before Abraham was born. Shem was still alive. In fact, Shem was only about two-thirds of the way through his life. So, if you stop and think about it, Abraham probably knew most of what we have in Genesis 1 through 11, probably much more. That he probably knew all that was revealed in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. What did Abraham know? Well, he knew about creation, the fall, the curse. He knew about the apostasy of mankind that took place before the flood. He knew about Noah. In fact, he probably could talk to Shem, who had gone through the flood. I'm assuming that he probably had some contact with Shem at some point. And so he certainly knew about the flood. In fact, this is it's interesting to observe that almost every, I mentioned this the other week, almost every civilization, ancient civilization, has a flood story of some sort. In fact, some of them even have, they talk about two people that survived, Noah and his wife, or a name similar to that. That's a very, it's worldwide. And then, of course, he would have known about the Tower of Babel and the spreading of the nations, which had all taken place, obviously, before Abraham came. But I want you to think for a moment about the fact that God had already started his plan, his whole plan of redemption was already started long before Abraham came. Okay, and I think Abraham, at some point or another, now when Abraham was called, what he knew and didn't know, I don't know, but there's something. I think there's something important to understand before we look at Abraham specifically, is to look at what God had already done and what God had shown already in relation to redemption in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And go back to Genesis 3, and I want you to look for a minute, and I'll explain why this relates, because you've got to understand, Abraham, the covenant to Abraham was not in a vacuum. It wasn't like all of a sudden God just came down to Abraham and this is where it all started. There was already a plan of redemption in progress, and I think Abraham understood that he was part of that. Whether he knew that immediately or over time, we don't know. But if you look at Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, which again is the great proto-evangelium, as it's called, this is what is really the original gospel, you might say. In verse 15, this is what he said to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. Now, this is not talking about women being afraid of snakes, although women, at least most women, my wife, hates snakes. But that's not the point here. The point is that he was talking about two seeds. An enmity between two seeds. The seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Now let me just stop and ask you. What does he mean by the seed of the serpent? What's he talking about when he says the seed of the serpent? Is he talking about snakes? Okay, children of who? Well, that would be maybe what you would be tempted to think, okay? But was he? What do you guys think? Was it the seed of the? What was the seed of the serpent?
I think that was the seed that wasn't the son of the chosen.
Okay. Well, when you say seed, seed is a very important concept in Genesis, okay? Well, we could almost say that eventually it might refer to that. But when we say seed, actually, the book of Genesis, what does Genesis mean? Beginning, but it actually refers to generations. It actually refers to the idea of begetting. And in fact, the whole way the book is organized is by the phrase, if you look at Genesis 2, verse 4. No, they don't translate it that way. It says, these are the generations. That's the organizing principle of Genesis. It says over and over again, these are the generations of. And the idea is that of offspring. So what was the offspring of the serpent that he's referring to? Yeah. He's talking about the people who would come from who? Eve. The seed of the serpent is from Eve. Okay? It's what the serpent produced because of what he had done in tempting them and causing them to sin, bringing them to the point they sinned. The seed of that, the fruit of that, was what Adam and Eve would bring forth. Wicked mankind. Who is the seed of the woman? Ultimately, yes. But where does the seed of the woman come from? The woman. Right? They both come from the woman. Whatever else you want to say, it is clear that there is being set up here immediately a conflict between two seeds, both of them going to come from Eve. There's a conflict between the seed of the serpent, what the serpent produced when he caused them to sin, and the seed of the woman. Now, I think this was a mystery to some degree to these men. But they all understood, the godly line understood. You can see it in Jacob. And we'll look at this maybe Genesis 49. They understood that this was referring to something. God was going to bring salvation in some way through the seed of the woman, whatever that meant. Okay, they knew it was going to come I believe they understood it referred to a person. But what I want you to observe here is that the seed of the serpent, first and foremost, was who? Cain. Cain was the fruit. If you look at chapter 4, now think about this. You don't think of it in this way, but listen. It says, now the man had relations with his wife Eve. This is chapter 4. And she conceived and gave birth to Cain. Cain was the first one with whom Eve experienced the curse. What was Eve's main curse? She would have pain bearing children. The very first one she bore was Cain. This was the first experience she had of that curse. Then notice, she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Again, she gave birth to his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. What was Adam's curse? He was going to have to work by the sweat of his brow, tilling the ground. The same vocabulary. This is like the epitome of the curse. Cain is the first, he's the seed of the curse. He's the one who came forth. He was the firstborn, and he came out and he tilled the ground. He was a farmer. He was the first one who he represents everything that Satan had done. He was the seed of the serpent. But consider Abel. Abel was the younger. Abel was what? What was his occupation? He was a shepherd. Now, this sets up immediately the conflict between the two seeds. And you understand that Cain killing Abel was a foreshadowing of this conflict that would be consummated in Christ. Now, I would suggest that when he says the seed of the woman, that I think that foreshadows the virgin birth. Because when you talk about the seed, usually you're talking about the seed of the man. When he talks about the seed of the woman, I think he's actually foreshadowing the virgin birth, which I think is implied also in the fact that all the mothers in Genesis were barren. Sarah was barren, Rebecca was barren, and Rachel was barren. All of them were barren. So that their giving forth, their bearing, was really miraculous. It was God intervening. It was obvious in Sarah's case, but all of them, it was God intervening. And I think it was, again, this was foreshadowing the fact that the seed of the woman would be a virgin birth. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, what I just want to emphasize is the conflict between Cain and Abel was the setting up of the understanding of what this seed meant. Okay? So right away, in Cain and Abel, you have a picture. When you have Cain killing Abel, you have a foreshadowing of this conflict of seeds. And if you want me to prove that, look at chapter 4. Verse 25. Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, for she said, God has appointed me another. I hate this. They translate. It should say seed. It says offspring. Another offspring in place of Abel. For Cain killed him. And then, when you come down to chapter 5, and it goes through Adam, who do you usually account, when you go through sons, who usually do you list? The first. The firstborn is the one that is accounted through, right? But if you'll notice in chapter 5 when it talks about the generations of Adam, it doesn't include Cain. It goes straight to who? Seth. See, I think they understood this concept that there was a conflict being developed between these two seeds. And so this concept is developed throughout the book of Genesis. And one of the main issues is the seed. And this conflict between seeds, and I don't have time to develop this. This is quite fascinating. I just really began to see this recently as I was studying it. This is the conflict between Ishmael and Isaac, the conflict between Jacob and Esau. I think it's totally, this is not mere coincidence. Jacob's name means heel grabber. It's the same word from the curse in Genesis 3:15 when he says, you will bite his heel. Or your seed will bite his heel. I could Then he changed his name to Israel, which meant you have prevailed. And the idea was that the younger would eventually prevail over the older, the older being the seed of the serpent. That's what Christ did. Christ supplanted the seed of the serpent. Does that make sense? You understand? That's what's going on in Genesis. That's part of the foreshadowing that's going on. And the people, the patriarchs, I don't think they fully understood everything, but I think they understood that the seed of Genesis 3:15 was pointing to an individual that would someday supplant what the serpent had done, would supplant the seed of the serpent. That's why this whole thing of the elder and younger in the book of Genesis, you know, when the younger is blessed instead of the elder and so forth, that's what it's pointing toward. Cain was the elder. He was the one who was, and you always find the elder in the book of Genesis, the elder one is always the one who is the hunter, the man's man, the leader, the guy who gets things done. He's the, even if you look at Cain, it was Cain's seed that, you know, created instruments and metalworking and had made all the advancements. They were the ones who were out front. They were the gifted ones. And it was always the younger. It says of Jacob, he was a plain man and dwelled in tents. I mean, that was the typical. And the point was that the younger one would supplant the seed of the serpent. Yes. Well, no, that's a good, it clearly is physical, although it's not to say that everybody in the line was saved, but clearly when you look at the genealogies in Genesis, the point is that this seed was going to come down this line. And I think that's the point of Genesis 5. When he says these are the generations of Adam, and he goes, instead of to Cain, he goes to Seth. He is, I think, purposely making the point that this seed was going to be the seed of Seth, not the seed of Cain. And so we have the same thing when we get to Noah and the flood, okay? He narrows it down in chapter 11 to who? Shem. Okay? It's clear, and we'll see this in a minute, but it's clear that he's narrowing it down who this seed is going to come from. Right.
Joseph, David, and Solomon. So what's the implication to this teaching? Or what's
to the Abrahamic covenant?
Yeah,
well, I'm going to get there.
Okay.
Yeah. Because my point is, I want you to see that the seed of the woman in Genesis 4 to 11 had already been narrowed down. It was narrowed down to Seth, it was narrowed down to Noah, and it was narrowed down to Shem. And I believe there's already a clear understanding that the seed was pointing to an individual who would bring salvation and would reverse the work of the serpent. Okay? The seed of the serpent. And that's kind of my point. Now, that leads us to Abraham. And what I want to emphasize is with Abraham, I believe Abraham understood, when we get to the Abrahamic covenant here, which we're going to start right now, I think Abraham understood that when God came to him and said that the nations were going to be blessed through him, I think he clearly understood it was a reference to Genesis 3:15. In other words, that it was going to be his seed that was going to go through his line. So he understood, and I think he understood that this was referring to, even as Paul said, Christ. He didn't know it was Christ. And I think that that's partly what Jesus meant when he said, Abraham saw my day and he was glad. I think what he's saying there is that Abraham knew that this blessing, this covenant that God made with him, was pointing to a person, Christ. I don't think that was news to Abraham. I think that's something he understood, because he understood what had already happened from Genesis 3 to 11. The seed had already been narrowed down greatly to his line, to Shem. And so we come to Genesis 12. I want that for a background, because I want you to see this isn't like out of nowhere. This isn't like Abraham, although Abraham was, as we find in Joshua 24, with his brother and his father, were in fact worshippers of other gods. It says in Joshua, Joshua said that in Joshua 24, before God called him. Probably a statement that most of these, not necessarily all of these men in this line were godly men, but it had been narrowed down to them. I want to talk a little bit about Abraham, and what I want to do for the remainder of tonight is simply look at Abraham, primarily Abraham. We'll make, look a little bit at Isaac and Jacob, but what I want you to see primarily is that the Abrahamic covenant, what God did with Abraham and the promises he gave to Abraham, really are the theme of this book, of Genesis. They're the theme of the book of Genesis, and it is also the basis for everything else, including all the covenants that come later, including the new, and Abraham is referenced often in the New Testament. But turn over to Genesis chapter 12, and you may want to actually just take a minute. On the last page of the handout I gave you. Yeah. The he that crushes his head is Christ. The seed of the woman would crush the head of the head of the seed of the serpent. Now the serpent, if you go back to 3:15, it says, "I will put enmity between you, that is between the serpent and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He," meaning her seed, "shall bruise you on the head, and you," meaning the seed of the serpent, "shall bruise him on the heel." And the point was that it is referring to the cross. And it reminds me of Hebrews 2, where the writer of Hebrews says, you know, that Christ destroyed the work of the devil. And I think it's taking us back to the point that it was Christ who reversed what Satan, the serpent, had done. He crushed the head of the serpent in his work on the cross. He reversed the curse. He reversed all that was done. Does that make sense? That you is the seed of the serpent. That's the point that's pointing to the fact that he would die on the cross. In other words, he would put him to death. There would be temporary victory. But when he resurrected, he overcame. Yes. The serpent bruised his heel. That is, he put him to death on the cross. So there was a temporary victory. But then Christ bruised him on the head when he rose from the dead. So at the cross, he was actually, even though Satan had bruised him on the heel, he had overcome. He bruised him on the head. Does that make sense? No, I think it's in every commentary probably read on Genesis. Genesis 3:15 is commonly called the Proto-Evangelium. That's how... Yeah. The idea... Well, it's the natural birth of Eve. It's all mankind. That's why Jesus could say to the Pharisees, "You're of the father. You're of your father, the devil," because they were of the seed of the devil. Because they were, and all of mankind is. Yes, it's the sin nature. Exactly. We are all born with enmity toward God. That was the work of the serpent. That was the seed of the serpent. That was the outcome of what the serpent had done. Yes, exactly. No, but it was. Setting up the conflict it was pointing to what the seed would do. It's not saying that there were some who weren't under the curse. It's simply saying it was a picture. It was a picture of what Christ would do. And I think Abraham understood that. How well he understood it or when he understood it, came to understand it, I'm not sure. We don't know. But I do think Abraham understood it based on what Jesus said. If you look at the handout, I did a little, I like charts, I'm sorry. But this is something I put together just reading Genesis. And I'll try to explain this briefly, and what I want to get out of this is I want you to see how the Abrahamic covenant was revealed. Okay, it wasn't revealed in a moment. It wasn't like one thing. It was revealed over time. So if you look at this whole length of this chart is Abraham's life. You can see there in the pink there is Abraham, 175 years. That's the length of the whole chart. If you look at the top where it says Genesis, those are chapter numbers in yellow. So that chapter 12 through 16 of Genesis is that short little period right there of 11 years in Abraham's life. Chapter 17 to 21 is a one-year period about 14 years later. And the event in chapter 22, which we read this morning when Abraham offered Isaac, was the one event that we know of in a 37-year period. And then the very end of his life, chapter 23 through 25, is at the very end of his life. I point that out because most of the appearances of God to Abraham occur in chapter 12 through 16 and chapter 17 through 21. Okay, they're in a very small part of his life, of his 100. Does that make sense? Again, not to confuse you, you can look at that at some point. But God appeared to Abraham 8 times. And every time he did, it was in reference to his covenant. And so I want to just trace that briefly tonight. Go to chapter 12. And we find that Abraham appears, or God appears to Abraham. It says, now the Lord, this is chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all families of the earth will be blessed. Now that is the first statement of what we call the Abrahamic covenant. It's not technically the covenant, which doesn't take place until chapter 15. But this is where God approached Abraham. And by the way, if you look at that outline, this happened in this first 75 years of his life. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. We don't know when it happened. We know it happened when he was in Ur of the Chaldees. This is something that God had appeared to him when he was in the city of Ur. And when we put the facts together, we go back to chapter 11. What happened was, Abram as he was known then, was living in Ur of the Chaldees. God appeared to him, and apparently he and his father and his family all picked up and went to Haran, which isn't the promised land, okay, but it wasn't Ur. And they were there for a while. We don't know how long. But after his father Terah died, it says he and Lot and the rest of his family all went to the promised land. It says in verse 4, so Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot with him. So let's just stop for a moment and point out several things about what God had told him here. Now, notice, first of all, in verse 1, it says, now the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country, from your relatives, and from your father's house. So he's basically telling him to forsake everything. You could almost say this is a cross-like experience. I mean, this is death to self. This is, Abraham had to give up his family, his house, his inheritance, anything that was he knew or of any importance, he was called to give up. And he says, I will show you, you're supposed to go to the land which I will show you. So Abraham doesn't even know at this point what the land is or where the land is. So obviously we call Abraham a man of faith, and this is obviously why. And he says, I will make you a great nation. and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you I will curse. And in you all families of the earth will be blessed. Now what I want to just mention here in these verses, first of all, notice that God made promises to Abraham personally that were fulfilled to Abraham in his day. He says, I will make you a great nation. He says, I will bless you, and I will make your name great. And it's interesting, actually, as you read Genesis, you find that he does, in fact, bless Abraham greatly. And he blesses him with a great name. And Abimelech calls him a great prince among them. Abram was blessed. In his life, he was blessed by God. Okay, and then notice there are also blessings made to in relation to those who would come forth from him. He says, I will make you a great nation. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you I will curse. And then he adds this, and in you all families of the earth will be blessed. That's what Paul refers to in Galatians chapter 3 when he says he preached the gospel to Abraham. And I think when he says, in you all families of the earth will be blessed, I think that's at least in part how Abraham knew that this is referring back to Genesis 3 and to that seed. But let's move on to the next appearance. If you look at what happens now, we're just going to trace briefly Abraham's life. If you look now, Abraham leaves Haran after his father dies. He goes to the promised land. He was 75 years old when he went into the promised land. And right away, he goes to Shechem. And if you look in verse 7, we find that the Lord appears to him. Well, let's just read again from verse 4. So Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took Sarah his wife and Lot his nephew and all their possessions which they had accumulated and the persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. Now Shechem is about in the middle of Israel, if you look at a map. But it says, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who appeared to him. This is the second time that we know of the Lord appeared to Abram. He doesn't say much, but apparently this is an affirmation. After he entered the land, this is an affirmation that God, in fact, would keep his promise. And he only says two things. Well, he really only says one thing. He says, to your descendants, or again, I hate the way to change this because it's the word seed. It says, to your seed, I will give this land. Now, this is the most fundamental aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. If there are two words that are important whenever the Abrahamic covenant is brought up, it is the two words seed and land. And when you talk about seed and land, you're talking about the two things that relate to eschatology. The debate is over seed and land. Okay, understand that. I'll explain that in a minute, or at some point, maybe next week. But this is the key concept in the whole Abrahamic covenant, that God would give a land, this land, to his seed. Now notice, when Abraham still doesn't know what the land is. He comes down to the land of Canaan, and he says, I'm going to give your seed this land. Well, Abraham doesn't have a seed. His wife is barren, and this land is just, I mean, there are no borders to this land. It's just, he said, I'm going to give you this land. So he's got a little bit more specific, but not very. Okay, this is Abraham, the man of faith. Now, the next time he appears is in chapter 13. Now, in chapter 12, you remember, he goes down to the land. He goes farther south. He sojourns. He's called a sojourner several times. He never really settles down anywhere. He ends up going into Egypt for a while because of a famine. Then he comes back. And when he comes back in chapter 13, he separates from Lot because they both have so many goods they separate. And Abram gives Lot the choice. Lot says, I'm going to take this really fertile area over here by Sodom and Gomorrah, which he does. He goes over to Sodom and Gomorrah. And when Lot leaves and he is separated, that's when God appears to Abram again in chapter 13. And he again reiterates the promise, becomes a little more specific. In chapter 13, verse 14, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. Verse 16, I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land, for through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Now, again, notice every time the Lord appears to him, he gives him a little more information. Now he says, look, northward, southward, eastward, and westward from where you are, this is the land I'm going to give you. So he's getting a little more specific, not just this land, but from every direction you can see, I'm giving you this land. And then he adds something else. He says, I'm going to give it to you forever. You can see that this is, I don't know, hopefully you can see how this relates to eschatology. When he says he will give you the land forever, what does forever mean? Does anybody? It means forever, okay? That's the debate. Does forever mean forever? Because if it does, then the land is still of importance. Well, he gets more specific. But he says forever more than just here, too. But at any rate, then he also adds to the fact that I'm going to make your descendants as the dust of the earth. So they won't be able to be numbered. Okay? So this is what he says in chapter 13. He's gotten a little more specific, a little more detailed. Now, in chapter 14, of course, is when Abram delivers Lot after the kings come and steal him away. The first battles that are recorded in the Bible in Genesis 14. And then after he comes back from that, Melchizedek comes and blesses him. Abram gives him a tenth of all the of his belongings or whatever. And then we come to chapter 15. Now, chapter 15 is technically the Abrahamic covenant. It's called that because this is where God ratified it. This is where God called it a covenant. This is the first place it's called a covenant. And I'm going to just read through this chapter and make some points as we go through it, okay? Chapter 15, after these things, the word of the Lord, this is the fourth time that the Lord has come, the Lord has spoken to Abram, came to Abram in a vision saying, do not fear, Abram. I'm a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless? The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. So notice, first of all, the first issue is the seed. God has promised him a seed and a land. And he says to God, well, what am I going to do for a seed? I mean, I had this Eliezer here from Damascus. He's the head servant. Is he my seed? And God says, no, I'm going to give you a seed. Okay. So in verse 3, he says, and Abram said, since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. So he promises it's going to be a son. Verse 5, and he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens. Count the stars if you're able to count them. That means a lot more to us now because we know now that there are literally billions of stars. We can't even count them all. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to possess it. He said, and this is Abraham speaking, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? So here's the next question. The first question was the seed. I don't have a seed. Where's the seed going to come from? The second question, Abraham, is how do I know I'm going to possess the land? I'm just a sojourner. Which he always was, by the way. He says, how will I know that I will possess it? So verse 9, so he said to him, bring me 3-year-old heifer and 3-year-old female goat and 3-year-old ram, turtle dove and young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses and Abraham drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abraham, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. Where's that? Okay, that's talking about Egypt. It says, "But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of Amorite is not yet complete." You understand the significance of Moses writing this book of Genesis? I'm sure that it wasn't new information, but this is, I mean, think about Moses writing this book, because that's what he's referring to. And he's referring to the fact of the Exodus. Verse 17, "It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram," there's the word, "saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land.'" And again, I don't know why they translated descendants. It's seed. "To your seed I have given this land. From the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadamite and the Hittite and the Pezzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite." Now notice what he has done here in the Abrahamic covenant. Again, he has expanded and defined more clearly. He makes it very clear that the seed is going to actually come from his own bowels. It's going to be his son. It's not going to be something, you know, some other person. It's going to be from, it's his son. And he defines clearly what the land is. He actually gives borders. He gives some kind of an area of the land. He said, "This land is yours forever. Your seeds forever." Okay? So that is officially the Abrahamic covenant. And then in chapter 16, what happens in chapter 16? Okay, they still can't have children. And Hagar, or what does Sarah say? "Well, you know, maybe you should just have a child. You know, maybe you should try to go into my handmaid, Hagar." So this is Abraham trying to help the Lord out, which never works well. And so, you remember, Hagar becomes pregnant. And it's after Hagar becomes pregnant and bears a son that... Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, I think the point of it is, and we'll talk about this more when we come to the other covenants, because it was actually prophesied that they would be away from the land for a long time. It's prophesied in the later prophets that they would actually depart, that they would be scattered over the whole earth and would not come back for a long time, and at the end of the time he would bring them back. But we'll talk about that more later. I don't want to get off on the eschatology right now, because I want to go through the covenant of Abraham. But that is the fundamental nature of the debate. And just understand, if I understand the argument correctly, whatever stripe, all premillennialists would argue that the land promise is a literal land promise. All postmillennialists and all millennialists would argue either that this was fulfilled in the Old Testament, or that the land means heaven, and that it's a spiritual reality now. But I don't want to get into that now, because that's getting into the eschatology part of it. What I want to do is simply go through what happened with Abraham. Yeah. No, they have not. I read that this week. No, they did not ever possess the full land. Not the full part of it, no. But look at chapter 17. Remember, okay, Abraham has had a son by Hagar, Ishmael. Now, What I want you to observe is the Lord does not appear to Abraham for another 14 years. Notice it says in chapter 16, verse 15, Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Now, in verse 17, verse 1, it says, now when Abram was 99. So here is 13 years. Abram has a son, Ishmael, and all this time, and we see this in chapter 17, all this time Abram is thinking that this is the seed. This is the seed God promised. But notice, God comes to Abram, chapter 17, says, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. Abram fell on his face. God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you will be a father of multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. So here's where his name is changed, age 99. It says, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. Verse 6, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings will come forth from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout your generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession. It's the third time he said everlasting or forever. And I will be their God. Verse 9, God said further to Abraham, now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. And here the sign of the covenant is given when he's 99. He says, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin. It shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. And every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised throughout your generations. A servant who is born in the house or who is bought with money from any foreigner who is not of your descendants. A servant who is born in your house or is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. This shall my covenant be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. But an uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. Now this is where the clincher came for Abram. He wasn't expecting this. Verse 15, then God said to Abraham, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. So she gets a new name. I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. This is the first time in all the Lord's appearances to Abram that Sarah is even mentioned. And he says, I'm going to bless her just like I bless you, and the seed is going to come through her. Now Sarah is an old lady. It says, I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Then Abram fell on his face and laughed, and said in his heart, which is what Isaac means, by the way, laughter. Will a child be born to a man 100 years old, and will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. This reveals the fact that Abraham just assumed that the seed, the answer to the promise, was Ishmael. For 13 years, and he's raising this child thinking he was the heir. And God says, no, I'm going to give you a son by Sarah. And he laughs. You know, that's ridiculous. and that's why he's named Isaac. So I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. As for Ishmael, I have made you, I'll stop there. But basically, this is a promise that it's not going to be Ishmael. It's going to come through Sarah. So understand that every time the Lord appears to Abram, he brings new information. He brings something more. Then in chapter 18, we won't read this, but yes. Well, the land is defined not only in Genesis, but throughout the Old Testament. I don't know that without studying it out, but I mean it's the land of Canaan. Well, that actually happens quite often in the Bible. Even, you know, we can think of Peter's name was changed, and it happens with Jacob. I don't know, again, that I could say something definitive about that off the top of my head. I'd want to think on that before I just would answer it. Some things come to mind, but I don't really want to say something I haven't really thought through. So let me think about that. There are a lot of things in here that if you stop to think about, you take for granted. I've often thought, why circumcision? It has something to do with seed, but why did God choose circumcision? You know, something we take for granted, we say, oh yeah, circumcision. But why? Why did God choose that? That seems so odd. I've thought about that a lot. I haven't come up with an answer. I haven't heard an answer that really satisfies me, but it has something to do with seed. It has something to do with reproduction, obviously. I mean, that's the significance of it, but I'm not quite sure I understand. I mean, it just seems odd. But at any rate, that was the sign that he chose. That was the sign of the covenant, and Abraham had everyone in his house, including Ishmael, circumcised because they were all in his house. Chapter 18, the Lord appears to him again and confirms that Sarah is going to have a son. And that son is going to be the one through whom the covenant comes. And then in chapter 21, verse 12, you can turn over there. Isaac is born. We have this brief statement. Isaac is born in verse 12, chapter 21. It says, God said to Abraham. This is the seventh time God spoke to Abraham. Do not be distressed because of the lad, that's Ishmael, and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her, for through Isaac your descendants shall be called. So he makes it clear that the covenant is going to be through Isaac. By the way, this is just for free. I love this. I love the name Isaac. There are two times when Isaac, there's a play on the name Isaac. Do you remember when Ishmael was mocking Isaac when he was born, and Ishmael was just a teenager? The word mocking is the word Isaac. He was Isaacing Isaac. And then the other word that, the other place that is kind of funny is you remember when he was down in Gerar, Isaac was with his wife, Rebecca, and he was sporting with Rebecca, his wife. Do you remember that? He was Isaacing her. Isaac was Isaacing her. The word is the word Isaac. The idea was that he was simply joking with her. He was obviously married to her, the point was. But it was just, I thought that's funny, because you don't catch that in English, but it's the word Isaac in the Hebrew. Isaac means laughter. And then finally, the last time that God appears to Abram is chapter 22, which we read this morning. Won't go through this, but basically this is a test, okay? And it's a test of Abram's obedience. He passes the test. And then let's just read towards the end here. If you go back down to verse 11. Well, let's go down to verse 15. So this is after all that he did. It says, verse 15, then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Now, I just want to point out, well, first of all, I should point out, this is a whole other discussion, but this is the verse that's quoted by the writer of Hebrews in Hebrews chapter 6. Which gives us great insight into Hebrews chapter 6, which is so debated by so many. But the point is longevity. Abram obeyed. I mean, you have Abram obeyed his whole life, and then God swore to him that he would. And that's kind of the point of Hebrews chapter 6. But we have Abram here, faithful, and proved his obedience. There's oftentimes one of the questions that comes up as well in the eschatology debate is the Abrahamic covenant conditional? Was it conditional on the obedience of the people? And the answer is no. It was conditioned on the obedience of one person, Abraham. And Abraham obeyed and therefore God swore. Well, that was their keeping of the covenant. But God swore. He didn't say, "I'll keep this covenant with you if you circumcise." God makes it clear several times in the book of Genesis that God, because of Abraham's obedience, he was going to bring this about. This is God's sovereign will. He says over and over again, "I will, I will, I will, I will." And God, it was conditional, we might say it was conditional on Abraham's obedience, but that was clearly fulfilled based on Genesis. Let me just say a couple words here, closing. Now, Abraham, what I find interesting, by the way, is there's probably close to 50 years, maybe more, after Genesis 22 of Abraham's life. We don't really know anything about. These things happened over very small periods of time in Abram's life. But at any rate, chapter 23, Abram gets a wife for Isaac. Chapter 24, buys a burial plot. Or I guess it's reversed. Chapter 23, he buys a burial plot. Chapter 24, he gets a wife for Isaac. And then he dies in chapter 25. And then we find the Lord appears to Isaac twice and repeats the promises of the seed and the land, and that you will be a blessing to the nations of the earth. And then he appears to Jacob six times. Most famously, I suppose, at Bethel with Jacob's ladder. And then again in chapter 35 when he wrestles with the angel. But God at Bethel reiterates the promises of the Abrahamic covenant. The promise that the seed, your seed, would inherit the land. That's always the focus of the promise. And then that you will be a blessing. Your people will be a blessing, or the nations of the earth will be blessing. And then, and I don't have time to go through all this detail, it's quite fascinating, but then notice the book of Genesis, look how the book of Genesis closes. Go to chapter 50. There's so much to say about this, because there's so much in Genesis about the Abrahamic covenant. But it closes. Now notice, God never appeared to any of the 12 sons, okay? Never appeared to Joseph. We know Joseph interpreted dreams. We know Joseph had a dream. But we have no place where it says the Lord said to Joseph. We don't have the Lord appearing to Joseph. We don't have the Lord appearing to any of them. But what we do have at the end of Exodus, or the end of Genesis, is the book is focused on the covenant given to Abraham. Look at verse 24. Joseph's about ready to die. He gathers his brothers together. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised an oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you, and I will carry my bones up from here." So Joseph made his brothers swear that when they would go up, that they would take his bones along into the promised land. But the whole book of Genesis is looking forward to the promised land, which of course comes in the rest of the Pentateuch and in the book of Joshua. But it's focused on the Abrahamic covenant. Now everything that happens from here on out is based on that covenant, including the old covenant, including the Davidic covenant, including the new covenant. It all has to do with these two things, seed and land, and so forth. So I'm going to stop there. Next week what I want to do is kind of summarize the Abrahamic covenant and give you some of the ramifications for eschatology. So we'll talk about the Abrahamic covenant in relation to eschatology more specifically, next week. And we'll probably talk a little bit about Galatians 3, which is also, you know, the other main issue. Didn't Paul say that we're the seed of Abraham and so forth, or that Christ is the seed of Abraham? And the answer is yes. But we'll talk about that next week. Any questions? Yes. Yes. That's not as simple as a one-sentence answer. That's what we'll look at next week. That's the sticky part. The question is, okay, the question is how, and this is where eschatology is sticky, because you have to ask the question, how does the church relate to these covenants? You understand it's the fundamental issue. And the Abrahamic covenant is the most fundamental one. It's the beginning. So the question is this, okay, in a nutshell. Does the church replace Israel, that's replacement theology, in the covenants, which I don't think they do. And the reason I say that is not just based on the Abrahamic covenant, it's because it's based on the new covenant in Ezekiel 36 and Jeremiah 31, which clearly link it to the land and the regeneration of the people of Israel. But or do we say, and this is how I would word it, we as Christians, the church, take part in the Abrahamic covenant, made clear by Paul, that we do partake in the blessings of Abraham, that we are his children by faith. You know, we all sing, Father Abraham had many sons, and you are one of them, and so am I. That's true. We are by faith, the sons of Abraham. But does that negate the promise of the land to his physical seed? That's the question. And I say no. I say emphatically no, based on the Old Testament. Nothing in the New Testament changes that. In fact, Paul even says in Romans 11 that they will be saved and they'll inherit the promises. So there's no place where Israel and church are confused in the New Testament. And that's where, again, a lot of the debate is. But I don't see any place where Israel is used for church. We are not the new Israel. Yes. That's a good question. I'm not sure I could tell you either answer to that question.
Could you research that?
I'll have to look into that. I'm not positive where it was first used, and I'm not positive what it means. Does anybody know? Esther? It's used in Esther? It is used in Esther. I don't know. Is that the first place? What were you saying, Grace? I'll have to look that up. I'm not sure when it was first. Yes. 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 I don't think it's not used in Genesis, I don't think. It's used Hebrew. Abram is called a Hebrew, but he's not called a Jew. So, any other questions? Dave, could you close us in a word of prayer?
I'll probably thank you, Lord, for